Hello and welcome to The Violin Chronicles, a podcast in which I, Linda Lespe, will attempt to bring to life the story surrounding famous, infamous, or just not very well known, but interesting violin makers of history. I'm a violin maker and restorer. I graduated from the French Violin Making School some years ago now, and I currently live and work in Sydney with my husband Antoine, who is also a violin maker and graduate of the French school, L'École Nationale de Lutherie in Mirecourt. As well as being a luthier, I've always been intrigued with the history of instruments I work with, and in particular, the lives of those who made them. So often when we look back at history, I know that I have a tendency to look at just one aspect, but here my aim is to join up the puzzle pieces and have a look at an altogether fascinating picture. So join me as I wade through tales not only of fame, famine and war, but also of love, artistic genius, revolutionary craftsmanship, determination, cunning and bravery that all have their part to play in the history of the violin. Welcome back to this final episode on the life of the not-so-well-known maker Francesco Ruggeri. I hope by now you have gained a deeper understanding of this maker and even a burning curiosity to see his work for yourself. In this last episode on Francesco, we will be looking at his children and where they fit into the story of this bustling city of Cremona, a town that will insist on turning out talented artisans over and over again. But to begin, let's go have a look at what downtown Cremona was looking like and why it was so alluring for the Ruggeri boys. Dwayne Rosengard.
Okay, so as far as we know, Vincenzo stayed with his father, you know, meaning in his father's household, with the implied, you know, situation where by being in the household, he's a contributing member to the workshop, to the activity of the workshop, right? Until 1689. And in 1689, Vincenzo Ruggeri married Barbara Ghisolfi. Where they married exactly, we don't know. It was clearly somewhere around Cremona, but we could never quite determine what church that happened in. Nonetheless, maybe we should cut in a parenthesis here, Linda. Let's go back to Francesco Ruggeri for a moment. Okay, we had talked about San Bernardo, the suburban parish just north of Cremona, right? Well, in about, somewhere about 1687, 88, maybe even 89, he moved to the next parish east of San Bernardo, and the parish is called Saints Fabiano and Sebastiano, Saints Fabian and Sebastian, and he bought a property there with a house. As far as we know, Vincenzo Ruggeri was a part of that move. When you turn the page to 1689, Vincenzo Ruggeri married Barbara Ghisolfi. They remained in the what we call the parish of San Sebastiano as a, you know, shortcut. They remained there. Their first child was born there in 1689. But then within the early months of 1690, Vincenzo Ruggeri moved into Cremona. And although we don't know exactly what house, it was a very small parish right where the current school of violin making is, you know, right on that main street there. Vincenzo Ruggeri eventually bought a home on that street, had numerous children himself, sons and daughters. He dictated a testament in 1719, and he died in 1719 as well. And that's, you know, the rough outline of Vincenzo's biography. So he had really almost 30 years, and it's kind of hard to get, you know, get one's mind around that, because there's nowhere near that the kind of violins, violas, cellos attributed to Vincenzo that would account for a 30-year activity.
Do you think he worked for other people?
I think it's possible, although I would say this. He was the last Cremonese violin maker. It's very, very interesting, Linda. He was the last Cremonese violin maker until the beginning of the 19th century. He was the last one to buy a home. Vincenzo was. And that occurred in, I believe it was 1698. And after that, nobody in the violin making trade for the length of the 18th century. Well, Stradivari bought his house in the 17th century, right? But no other maker in the 1700s could or did purchase a home. Very, very interesting, right? Vincenzo Ruggieri's youngest son was called Carlo, and he was born in 1707. His godfather at his baptism was the Cremonese violinist Gaspare Visconti, who's even in the early 18th century was recognized as the greatest violinist of Cremona and one of the greatest violinists to emerge from Italy. Most of his musical career, however, took place in London, and he married an English woman called Stefkins, Christina Stefkins. I think that's an incredibly important thing, that Vincenzo Ruggieri was in that kind of intimate rapport with Visconti. And by the way, this is literally within months after Visconti returned to Cremona from his long residency in London. It's a very interesting moment in music history, too.
Yeah, because it sort of shows that he was he was dealing with the very famous musicians, because we often say, you know, Ruggieri, he was more like the second rate.
Or second tier or something. Yeah, yeah. There's another deed in the Stradivari arsenal, because Stradivari had a lot of money and there's a lot of legal deeds, notary deeds. And in one of them, Gaspare Visconti and his father, in this case, were present at the drafting of the deed. By the way, there's still Stradivari workshop relics in the Museo del Violino in Cremona with the name of Visconti's wife on the actual object. She was a gamba / cello player, and obviously the Stradivaris knew them, but it was quite a surprise to learn how Vincenzo Ruggieri knew him too. I thought that was really, really wonderful.
Yeah. Maybe his wife played on one of his, you know, new smaller cellos.
Right. Or maybe, who knows what Visconti played on? Did he play on a Strat or did he play on his rival Ruggieri? What did he play on? Right.
Mm. In 1687, when Francesco was in his mid-50s, he moved his workshop to the parish of San Sebastiano. San Bernardo is northeastish of the centre, and now they are moving just east of the town, about equal distance to the centre compared to where they were before, and about a half-hour walk from their old house. Giacinto, their eldest son, was 26, Vincenzo, 24, and Carlo, 21, and they were all working with their father. Perhaps they needed a bigger space. 3 years earlier, Niccolò Amati, the big name in Cremona, died, and things were definitely picking up for the Ruggieris. Sure, there was Andrea Guarneri, a good maker in town, but he was starting to get old, and Antonio Stradivari was definitely trying to make his mark. But the Ruggieris had 5 able-bodied men working in their shop, and Girolamo Amati II was having his own problems keeping the boat afloat. This was their time to shine. Emily Brayshaw.
So we need to remember too that Cremona throughout this period too is very much a mercantile city. And so even though we sort of have the decline of these industries, they are still trying to build it back up. And so the production of things like dress and fabric and accessories too, they're really important components of a thriving bourgeois commercial society. You've got like a real explosion in fashion in the Baroque too. And this would have come through in Cremona. A fashion like military and war fashion.
Yeah.
And so that's...
Well, the thing is they had this like... There was this kind of inventor guy called Alessandro Cappa, and he was this engineer, and he had this boutique in Cremona with all these little inventions, a little bit like, you know, Leonardo da Vinci. And
yeah.
He had these war inventions and he had these agricultural inventions, and a lot of the sort of scientific stuff done, they would follow the armies, these engineers. They would be like, an army coming through. Yep, going with it. And historically, a lot of even medical and scientific advances have happened from wars and military. And so I feel like because Cremona was this like point in which all these armies passed, there was all this knowledge as well. And so I was wondering about, you know, was there a particular fashion, because I think the armies coming through, it was just a part of their life.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. I think something that comes through, so we sort of see Baroque, particularly by the time it really moves to the fashion, moving to the French courts, we sort of see Baroque becoming a global style, French, English, European Baroque becoming a global style. But what's happening really interesting, and you are talking about the military, is in 1660, really, at this time, we have a regiment of people from Croatia, mercenaries from Croatia, arriving in France. And they wore this particular type of traditional military kit, which was these picturesque scarves that they knotted around their throats. And the French just, like, loved it. And immediately imitated it. And this is where we get this cravat word coming from, which is a corruption of the word Croat.
Oh.
Right? And so people would immediately tie lace or muslin and silk if they had a little bit more, or around their necks, they'd maybe tie them in a bow or a button and a tuft, which would hang down. And it was first called a croat, but it's been corrupted to cravat. Officers and people of rank really had the big lace ones with, like, expensive Venetian lace in them. Or the lower classes, they would made them from cloth or cotton, best black taffeta plaited, which was tied around the neck with two small strings. And of course, civilians really take this further and really go over the top with these incredible Baroque cravats, which is essentially like a ribbon and a big, huge ruffle of lace sitting at the collar around 1660. So you've got this coming through, and Charles II, of course, coming back from, you know, at the Reformation in England, the Restoration, sorry. He's a type of adornment, put it around the collar, ties it with a bow knot. And he also brought, like, this new type of coat as well, the justaucorps. And King Charles II called it a vest, but it's a long collarless coat. And so you have this lack of the collar, and that helps with the cravat's popularity, because you don't have, like, the collar or the lapels, so you can stick the cravat there and it looks amazing. And so you've got well-made cravats being a status symbol. And, of course, in Italy they would have been worn as well. By the 1670s you could buy them ready-made, and it was the dominant form of neckwear and had completely displaced lace collars and ruffs. So the Dutch still hung on to those big cartwheel ruffs for a long time after they went out of fashion in other parts of Europe. The Spanish also liked the big ruffs, but earlier in the 17th century you get sort of these, they're called a falling band, and they're like these collars that sort of fall down that are trimmed with lace, but the cravat just really overtakes that as well. So we've got this.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, so we do have, like, a couple of key military pieces coming through influencing fashion. Certainly, you know, there is a history of that. How that translated to Cremonese style, I can't say.
Well, they must have had something, like, tied around some
sort. Oh, yeah. I mean, they would have. Oh, yeah. I mean, I guess what I'm trying to say is how the Cremonese responded to the invading armies on their own doorsteps, I don't know.
Yeah, yeah,
but
yeah.
Certainly these big styles would have trickled to Cremona and definitely been worn.
Because they weren't necessarily invading. They were kind of passing through. You'd always go through Cremona. It's like those, you know, highway stops that you, like, everyone's like, oh, yeah, no Cremona. It's like the petrol station on the way. But the 1670s to 1680s, that was sort of, Ruggieri was working. That was his, the height really of the success of the workshop he had. His three or four sons working with him. They were all making lots. They had this prolific production, actually. And it was at this time that the, you know, the cravat was flourishing. So maybe they were all there.
Definitely.
With their linen.
Yeah, absolutely.
The cravat.
Their justaucorps.
Their justaucorps.
Definitely. Probably a wig too.
Their hair, growing their hair longer. Or, like, maybe all the boys are growing their hair longer. And Ruggieri's like, oh, what's this, these young people with their long hair. And
Yeah, with
pointy
the,
beards.
Yeah, with the wigs too. By the 1670s, the guys have shaved off their beards.
Oh, they've no
again.
Beards.
Okay. So you're a bit like clean shaven. Right, we're okay. Starting to move in that too. So that's kind of interesting. Yeah.
And then you get an army come through, and you'd like pick up a little fashion tip.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, you would like just, I mean, and it might be just a way of, you know, something like how you roll your sleeves, or whether or not, you know, you wear your shirt a little bit baggier rather than tucked in super tight. Like these tiny little tweaks that we can make to how we wear our dress can translate into something that might be perceived as fashionable.
The workmanship of the Ruggieri followed the pattern of the Amatis, but was characterized by slightly higher arching, and in the case of their cellos, the production of smaller models that today have become standard. Francesco's cellos were about 10 centimeters smaller than those of his contemporaries in Cremona at the time, and in instrument making, 10 centimeters is a lot. Jason Price.
Ruggieri is really the first to make a smaller model cello, which is along the lines of the sort of modern day cello proportions that we have now. He wasn't the first to do it, and that's an interesting subject, but he was really the first to make a mass production of them. He made a lot of cellos, which are, you know, 75.2, 75.5 centimeters in body length, which have proportions in the bouts kind of like normal cellos, and a stop length like today's cellos. And that's interesting because Niccolò Amati didn't do that. Stradivari took a long time to get to that. You know, he'd be another 50 years or so before he, you know, in the early 1700s decade, he started making cellos which were this size. Some of the Brescian makers, there are a couple Maggini cellos which are of a similar size, but the proportions are actually kind of wacko on those. They're a bit more bulbous and wide. There are some Filius cellos, some Giuseppe Filius Andrea cellos, which are of this size, but that's also a little bit later. Ruggieri, for whatever reason, just realized that, listen, we can make a cello which is smaller than these, you know, monster bassettos that people are making, and they work. And so he made a lot of them. That's probably his most lasting contribution are the really excellent cellos that he made, which are of modern usable size.
After moving into their new home, Vincenzo, the third son, married and moved into central Cremona to join the other makers, Amati, Guarneri and Stradivari. He was probably still doing some work for his father, but now that he had his independence, he wanted to make a go of it with the cool set in town after having grown up literally on the outskirts of the city. Vincenzo's workshop was doing well. 3 years after he married and moved away, his elder brother, Giacinto, in 1692 married as well, and he too moved into town, into a house in the same street as the Amati workshop. He could have been helping out Girolamo Amati II, who was struggling with the running of his shop, or even working for his brother, Vincenzo. The Stradivari and Guarneri workshops were just around the corner, so he also could have been working for anyone in the area. Francesco was in his late 60s and three of his sons had moved away. Giovanni Battista had just moved again into the centre of Cremona, into the same street as his little brother Vincenzo and his workshop. Presumably the older brother was working for his little brother. Dwayne Rosengard.
Giovanni Battista was married in 1677 in San Bernardo, where you have to go rewind to the San Bernardo era. And he married a woman called Apollonia Mangiavacca. And they had, oh my gosh, I think it was 5, 6, 7, 8. They had 8 children. And their first 2 children were actually born in the city of Cremona. So what that means is that Giovanni Battista Ruggieri got married in 1677. Then he moved into Cremona, but that didn't last more than a few years. And he moved back to San Bernardo, presumably to the family compound, right, in San Bernardo. And then Then he too was a part of the move of Francesco and the entire Ruggeri operation from San Bernardo to San Sebastiano. Then another date that I don't think we could ever really nail down, but after 1690, G.B. Ruggeri then again moved back into the city. And I think I calculated once that Francesco Ruggeri had 21 grandchildren. It's a respectable number, right? And Vincenzo Ruggeri had at least 21 grandchildren. It's extraordinary, right? That in a time when infant mortality was just normal, but accepted, and it was... And of course, you know, infant mortality struck all of these families. Of course it did, right? But to a far less degree than the average, in the case of the Ruggeris, for certain. G.B. Ruggeri moved back into Cremona, and he died in 1711 in the parish, actually just immediately adjacent to where his brother Vincenzo lived. And he had, I think, lived there about 10 years. And I must say, you know, by way of a disclaimer or whatever you want to call it, that the future course of the family or the descendants of G.B. Ruggeri, Giovanni Battista Ruggeri, is completely unknown to me.
This only left him with Carlo, his youngest. Gaecinto, the second son, died at the age of 36, and he had a son called Antonio, who was also a violin maker, but his work is unknown to us. Dwayne Rosengard.
Giacinto was actually the second Giacinto born to Francesco Ruggeri. The first Giacinto died as a child, as an infant, and Giacinto, the violin maker, was born in 1661, and he too seems to have followed a lot of this. He stayed with the family, moved from San Bernardo to San Sebastiano, and then in 1692, he married a woman from Cremona. And within a little while, they moved to the famous tiny little alley street where the Amatis had always been, the Contrada Coltellai. And Giacinto Ruggeri seems to have operated from there, and then he died at age 36 in 1697. I don't know if we know anything about what became of his widow, who was called Caterina Pena, and he's maybe, yeah, one of the great enigmas, because he seems to have wanted to be right there in the center of violin making with Hieronymus Amati II, who was his, like, literal neighbor, you know, meters away. And then just around the corner, of course, were the Guarneris and the Stradivaris. Yeah, died tragically young.
A year after Giacinto's death, the father, Francesco, died and was buried in the church of San Trinita. But knowing his time was almost up and feeling a bit abandoned by his other sons, perhaps Francesco changed his will just a few days before his death, leaving all his tools to his youngest son, Carlo, who had not left his side. Though this may be, we have almost no examples of his work, so he may have continued on with other work after his father's death or gone to work with his brothers in town. Dwayne Rosengard.
We take another step back. We come to the fourth son, the youngest son of Francesco Ruggeri, Carlo. Now, Carlo was born in 1666. He seems to have followed that move from San Bernardo to San Sebastiano. And then in 1700, he married a widow called Lucrezia Laviosa. And Lucrezia Laviosa had a daughter by her first husband who had died. This is very interesting because why? In 1698, we have the testament of Francesco Ruggeri, the old man, and he leaves the workshop tools and instruments to Carlo. That's in 1698. Then, in 1700, Carlo marries this woman who's older than him, who already has a child, Lucrezia, and they establish themselves. They have a household in Cremona. Carlo Ruggeri cello, that is just a great thing. And it's dated 1706 and shows that Carlo Ruggeri was every bit as able as his brothers to construct a very fine instrument. The materials wouldn't pass for deluxe in the same way Stradivari would use deluxe materials making a cello, but Carlo Ruggeri knew his craft. Now, the part that gets all the publicity and all the discussion is that Carlo Ruggeri met a mysterious and violent death in Cremona in May of 1713. And what happened was, according to the record, is that his body was found outside of the Porta Mossa. And so that means the Mossa Gate, which is one of the gates on the south end of Cremona. And his body was found there. As far as we know, nobody was investigated. Nobody was ever prosecuted or tried for that crime. And Carlo was the last of the five Ruggeris that was buried in the, it was at the time, it was called an Oratorio of the Holiest Trinity, the Santissima Trinità. And Carlo was buried there, as was his father and three brothers. And this is important because there was a lay association affiliated with the Oratorio of the Holiest Trinity. And all of the Ruggeris at one time or another were members of that Catholic lay association.
So wait, when you say they were part of a like association, what does that mean?
Well, back then, you know, if we wind the clock back to 1600, 1700s, the only normally legally accepted men's associations were confraternities or other lay societies that were affiliated with either a church or with an oratory or an orphanage or some other identifiable charitable Christian scope. Otherwise, you know, you wouldn't be able to start a political party or have a weekly meeting about the prospect of revolution or something like that.
So it's like their club.
Yeah, it's like some people call it a club. And certainly here and there, there's bits of evidence that show that indeed they were little more than clubs, right? But in the case of the Lay Society of the Holy Trinity, they were charged with maintenance of the oratory. In other words, they have the upkeep of the building, make sure it was clean. And, you know, in its early days, they would have commissioned paintings, woodworkers to decorate and furnish the interior. It's notable because it's the only burial place of the famous violin makers of Cremona. It's the only burial place that still exists. Mm. You know, Stradivari, Stradivari, Amati, Bergonzi.
Yeah, because we don't know. Yeah.
Guarnieri, Gennaro. All their birthplaces have been paved, you know, demolished, paved over, and there's something else now.
Yeah, and so I'm thinking of Carlo mm-hmm. and his mysterious demise. And so what comes to mind straight away is the widow he married. You know, it's statistically speaking, it's the spouse. So it would be interesting to see who she married afterwards. Wait, how long were they married for?
About 13 years.
Yeah, and then, you know, she's like, if he disappears, I get all his wealth and I can move on and marry someone else.
Yeah, but I don't, it's a good question how much wealth there was. At least in the research we did, we could never determine, you know, in other words, it's true that Carlo Ruggeri received money from his wife as dowry when they married in 1700. This is definitely true. And that's a very interesting document because Carlo Ruggeri signed it with his own name. And his brother Vincenzo was a witness. And the notary said that Vincenzo was illiterate. In that doc, this is just in that one document.
Oh.
However, when Vincenzo Ruggeri died, by law and by custom, of course, the widow would have reclaimed her diary, so to speak, even though they, you know, had spent all or most of it on home furnishings and the like, right? The truth be told, nobody I know of has researched the widow of Carlo Ruggeri to find out what the remainder of her life story is. It could also be interesting.
She could have gone on to marry several more times.
Well, I don't know about that, but at least once, yeah.
Vincenzo is the most well-known of Francesco's sons, and he ran a successful business making many instruments. He based his model on Niccolò Amati's grand pattern and continued making smaller cellos like his father, although his arching is lower than his father's, more like that of Stradivari. Vincenzo is less famous than his father, but he is significant in that he was the first teacher of another important Cremonese maker called Carlo Bergonzi. Carlo's mother was godmother to Vincenzo's daughter, so the families were indeed close. But to hear about that maker, you will have to wait for a future episode. This brings us to an end of the story of the Ruggeris, but now we're going to start looking at the other maker, Ruggeri. Now, why should we remember Francesco Ruggeri? Well, this maker really popularized the cello in its smaller format that we know today. And when the other big names in Cremona were concentrating on large violin production, Ruggeri and his four buff boys churned out some incredible instruments that are still being played and cherished today. I see Francesco as a bridge in the Cremonese history of violin making between the Amatis and the Guarneri family that are soon to follow. But do stick around, as next week we will be starting the life of Giovanni Battista Ruggeri, another maker, confusingly living at the same time. I would like to thank my guests, Dwayne Rosengard, Jason Price, and Emily Brayshaw for joining me today. To support the podcast, you can leave a rating and review on your listening app, and I hope to catch you next time on the Violin Chronicles.